Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
I'm very pleased to welcome the director of this wonderful movie, Source Code. Please welcome Duncan Jones.
Thank you. I just wanted to get a picture so I could tweet it to everyone.
He's been busy tweeting about the museum, so if he starts doing that during the discussion, yeah, don't worry.
Sitting over here.
What's your Twitter handle or name?
Man-Made Moon.
Man-Made Moon, so you can follow, or you could tweet to him now, I guess. So the movie, like right from the beginning, it's sort of this movie... It sort of pays homage in a way to Alfred Hitchcock. It makes you think of Hitchcock and North by Northwest, just with the music at the beginning and the movement and action. So it's a very different tone than the first movie you made, which is Moon. So could you talk a bit about what type of movie you set out to make?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very, very different experience, obviously. Moon was something very personal that I wrote and with Nathan Parker and... this was a script which was sort of introduced to me, and I sort of came on board as almost a gun for hire in some ways.
Yeah.
But you know, when I was reading the script, there was just so many ideas just coming out all at once, and the idea of an ordinary guy in extraordinary circumstances sitting on a train across from a mysterious dame, it just felt like a Hitchcock movie to me.
Yeah.
So other than the science fiction ideas, you know, it felt right.
And so. Working with a script that was not your own,
yeah.
What did you feel that you could bring to it? What were some of the things that you, added to it in terms of the style or tone?
Well, you know, Jake was actually the person who introduced me to the script. He gave it to me. He'd seen Moon, and we'd had a meeting, and I very much wanted to work with him. I think he's an amazing actor. I really do. I'm a huge fan of his. Pretty good performance in this too.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he I think he saw similarities between Moon and the Source Code script that I didn't really notice. And when I was reading it, I was getting very excited about how different it was.
Right.
And my main take on the script was that, you know, it's got amazing action, it's got a wonderful pace to it, a really well-honed structure. But I found that the tone of it was quite serious, the draft that I read. And my big take, the thing that I wanted to tweak was lightening the tone and try and find ways to inject some humor into the film.
Right.
And that was, you know, that was my big addition to it.
Which was a trademark of Hitchcock, of course, as well. I mean, he's also making a film, like in North by Northwest, it's about a character who loses his sense of identity.
Yeah.
Cary Grant doesn't know who he is anymore.
Yeah.
But it's a lightweight film, too.
Again, I think that's kind of where, in those small ways where we had the opportunity to pay homage to Hitchcock, we tried to sneak them in there. There's the opening title with sort of very graphic line. There's the way that Jake is dressed. But basically every head of department had an opportunity to sneak something in there. So for wardrobe, it was the way that Jake was dressed as a school teacher. And for, you know, there's the opening titles. Then there's obviously the score. And even from the production design, the train station with the clock tower and another clock on the platform, there was an opportunity to try and get that shot.
Tell us about the performances and about your work with Jake, because it's so interesting to see how the character changes, you know, and how I love the first scene when you realize right away that he doesn't know who he is, and you, the audience has to sort of figure it out with him.
Well, you know, Jake and I really wanted to work together, and we discussed the script, and I told him my suggestions as far as trying to sort of lighten the tone. I think collaboratively we had a lot of fun. I mean, we had a week of rehearsal time before we started shooting the film, and we actually started with the stuff inside the train. So we had a week of rehearsals with Jake, myself, and Michelle Monaghan to really, you know, and work out and nail down what the structural necessities were of those scenes, because it was confusing. And I think for each of our main principal actors, there was huge acting challenges. For Jake, it's the obvious ones. I mean, he's carrying the film and he has to go through this quite complicated arc. But for Michelle in particular, the challenge is that she has this 8-minute segments, which is repeated throughout the film. She has an arc that she's trying to build over the course of the entire film. but she has to break that arc down into segments which always start at A and end at a different, you know, A, B, A, C, A, D, A, E over the course of the whole film. So you still want to have a progression, and you still at the end of the film want to feel that she's changed, but she's got a much smaller period to change over.
Yeah. And then how did you deal with some of the sort of logic issues and complicated issues about time travel? You know, there is, the basic way that I understand it is that you can't really go back in time and change the past. That there maybe will be a time in the future when people can travel into the future. You know,
It's a very easy way to travel into the future. You just go to sleep for a few hours, and all of a sudden you're there.
Okay, I'll try. I have to try that. Yeah,
What Ben Ripley came up with, and I thought was really kind of a neat conceit, a science fiction idea, is that the source code was something that was sort of misunderstood by the people who'd even designed it, and that what they believed to be the case was actually an access or a creation of a parallel reality each time it was used. So that kind of all of a sudden opens up the possibilities of how this thing worked. It's not only that you're creating a parallel reality, but you're sort of traveling. You're traveling backwards and creating a parallel reality. So back to the moment, these 8 minutes, which are on this train,
yeah.
And that sort of that idea, sort of setting that up, was gave us all sorts of opportunities to kind of run with it.
It seems like a film that must have been incredibly carefully prepared, just because of the special effects and the way that you're filming on the train. It seems like it would take a lot of planning and storyboarding. At the same time, it has a real sort of looseness to it. Because we didn't even talk about the chemistry that Michelle Monaghan and Jake have. I mean, that spark they have is really important to the film.
Well, I mean, I was hugely fortunate that I was able to assemble a cast of really top tier actors. And beyond Jake and Michelle, we obviously have Vera Farmiga, who's an amazing actress, and Jeffrey Wright, who I absolutely love. Moon's done a lot of good for me, and the fact that those actors had seen that film, why I was able to get these people to come on board. So, yeah.
Because of Sam Rockwell's unbelievable performance. Yeah.
And the fact that Kevin Spacey was willing to squeeze himself into a robot box for an entire movie.
That's how you did that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what was it, you said that you didn't in the beginning see similarities to Moon.
Yeah.
But obviously there are so many things. Like, so after the fact, what did you sort of learn about source code? Maybe.
Well, to be honest, it was Paul. It was the legendary Paul Hirsch who was the editor on the film. For those of you who don't know, Paul Hirsch edited Empire Strikes Back, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Footloose. What else? He won an Oscar for Ray, and there's one that was Mission Impossible as well. And he's doing the new Mission Impossible right now. There's actually a load more films, but those are the ones that I can sort of get off the top of my head. He was the one who sort of picked up on the fact that there were similarities with Moon, and he started, you know, mentioning them, and I became increasingly disappointed in my lack of creativity and the fact that I was going back to so many ideas I'd already addressed. But identity and...
But that's what great directors do. I mean, they...
Yeah, but
they,
not after they, two movies. Hopefully you got more than two movies worth
but
of
you'll
ideas.
Make, you're going to make some more, right?
Yeah. the question of identity and the idea of an authority... That is taking advantage of an individual who's in a situation where they can't really get out of it. So I guess those are the more obvious similarities.
Yeah. Could you talk a bit about the ending? You know, what your thoughts were, if there was any evolution about how the film how the film ended.
Hopefully, some people will enjoy it and get it, and other people will. At least it'll give them food for thought. Or something to discuss, even if they hate it. but I pushed for the ending that we have, just before anyone is wondering about that. I am a science fiction fan and geek, and I felt that there was this because you set up this great idea of this great science fiction conceit. There was this loose thread that just wasn't addressed in the script ending. The script ending was very romantic and sweet, and in my opinion, a little Hollywood. You know, they kind of disappear off in happily ever after, and that's the end of the movie credits roll. And I just felt like, you know, okay, so Colter Stevens has taken this leap into a parallel reality. Now he's in a reality which is just as real as the one he's come from, where he's stopped the train blowing up. He's taken over the body of Sean Fentress, who is now dead. permanently without a bomb going off. So there's a little ethical gray area there.
Right.
he's yeah, and also the fact that now he's stopped the bomb going off means he's never been sent on the mission in the first place. So back at the facility where Goodwin and Rutledge work, there is a Colter Stevens locked up in a box being prepared for a first source code mission who could be there in perpetuity. And really, he feels a responsibility to try and save this Colter Stevens who's in this parallel reality. So you have two there. Another ethical interesting point, though, is that every time Colter Stevens gets sent to through the source code and fails at his mission, he is now creating a new reality where a terrorist event is killing hundreds of people. So maybe they should have thought about that, because they're killing people.
Right. Okay, let's take some questions from the audience. So raise your hand if you have a question, and I'll repeat them just to make sure everybody hears. So back in the middle there. Yeah.
First, I want to say I really enjoyed the movie, so good job.
Thank you.
Go ahead. That's
yes, two of you. Yes.
I just wanted to ask. I've been following basically the development of your career because I'm stalking it. I was wondering. You know, you've been trying to get Mute off the ground for
yeah.
a while. And I was wondering if you feel like. I was happy when I saw this that a lot of your trademarks from Moon seem to be here, which you kind of discussed about the themes and stuff. And I was wondering if.
Yeah.
Blade Runner, which obviously didn't do well.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if maybe you think that this could help.
So the question is about the Project Mute, which is people have been hearing about for a while, yeah. Is something that you're interested in doing.
I won't belabor the point, but Mute is a very difficult sell. One of the biggest, well, there's two main problems with Mute that make it a difficult film to get made. One is it's a science fiction film which doesn't rely on a particular science fiction conceit or idea. It's a film noir, a bit like Blade Runner, although Blade Runner obviously had, you know, the replicants. It's a film noir that just happens to take place in the future. So it's, you know, for film investors, it's like, why are we setting this film in the future? Can't you just do it now? It'll be much cheaper and easier to do. I was like, no, that's not the point. and secondly, and this one I completely understand, and when you're trying to get a film made, especially these days, at a budget, and by a budget I mean more than $5 million like we did Moon, you need an actor of a certain level to bring in the financing, to sort of make the financiers feel confident that the film is going to make enough money to make it all back. To find an actor who is willing to put their career on the line, because they're doing that every time they do a movie, to put their career on the line for a main protagonist who doesn't talk at all is difficult, understandably. And it would be, you know, I'm not so keen to get it made that I'm willing to rewrite Mute for the Mute to talk. Although it has been suggested. Can't he just like, can it be voiceover? Can't he just be sort of, no. So what we're going to do is we're going to try and make it as a graphic novel first, which was seems to be the way to get things made these days. And also for those people who are interested in seeing Mute, even if I don't get to make it until I'm in my 80s, at least people will get a chance to sort of see the story for themselves in one form. In the meantime, I'm going to do another science fiction film anyway, so.
So because it ends where he's alive and we don't see him ever doing the source code or has not yet initiated, this could become a TV series.
Oh, because it ends with him alive, he's suggesting that this could become a TV series, yeah.
And begs for a sequel. Is that a consideration?
It was not a consideration, although when I suggested the ending, the producers got very excited, obviously. But obviously, I had my reasons for doing it, and it wasn't anything to do with sequels or TV series. Although, speaking of TV series, I hope you picked up the little the cameo in the film by Scott Bakula from Quantum Leap, which as the voice of Jake's father. So,
okay, right over here. Do you think that technology like the source code should exist, and could it do more harm than good?
I think that this particular technology, the ability to create entirely new realities, is way, way too big a responsibility for human beings to have. So no, I'm not a big fan of the idea of this technology working. But I'm not a technophobe. I love technology, and I do think that technology will be our salvation. I just don't think that this particular one is a good thing.
Okay, right over here.
I'm sorry to ask such a geeky question.
Yeah.
But in Moon,
yes.
Did the astronaut on Earth who was retired know that his clone was up there?
Oh, okay, we're going to Moon now. Did the astronaut who's on the Earth know that his clone was up there? You've been holding this question for a while. Yeah.
I am happy to allow interpretation on this particular point. I would imagine, though, that the machinations that would be required to have Sam Bell go through all of this and not have him know what's going on are too great to believe that he wasn't in on it. The original Sam Bell must have been in on it. Basically, the idea is that the guy who's obviously sold his soul and bought a beautiful house for his, you know, for his wife and daughter, and that's really, you know, he paid for it by agreeing to this situation.
Okay, back there.
Yeah,
go ahead.
In the scene where Jake jumps out of the train, can I ask you how you did that? It looks so real.
Oh, the scene where Jake jumps out of the train. How did you film that? That looks very real.
Absolutely. I mean, I that's where I got a chance to really geek out, because I obviously was very, very limited by my budget on my first film, but it gave me some opportunities to sort of try and think creatively about how to do things. On Source Code, although the budget was bigger, we still had to be fairly creative on how the money was spread and where we really sort of went for our big moments. I worked with an amazing VFX supervisor, a guy called Louis Morin from Montreal, and we basically picked our moments where we were going to kind of go to town with the money that we did have. And that was one of the shots that I really wanted to do. It's a combination of live action where Jake Gyllenhaal jumps off of our train film set onto a crash pad. And literally the moment his toe hits the ground, we went to what's called a virtual stuntman, which is a computer-generated version of Jake who has enough physics that they can actually collapse and roll in a human-like way. And then that converts back to live action Jake about 2.5 rolls into the roll, and so Jake finishes off the roll. Now, a virtual stuntman has never been used this close up to camera before, and we were literally chasing, you know, playing chicken with the technology in the hopes that the technology would catch up by the time we had to do our post-production. And fortunately, we worked with an amazing, amazing guy who was able to, fulfill this dream of mine to use a virtual stuntman this close to camera. But the whole shot, the whole sequence is actually an homage to a computer game called Grand Theft Auto. You're laughing? I'm heartbroken. Being a bit of a geek myself and a gamer, there's this great thing in computer games where you obviously don't have to cut around the action in order to hide your stuntmen. And I wanted to do that shot in a film where the camera stays with him the whole time, literally as he jumps out of the train. So this is a camera, by the way. The camera rotates around him as he jumps off the train and pulls out, and he jumps towards camera and does that roll right in front of us. And you can actually see all the cuts and bruises appearing as he rolls.
What was the learning curve like for you, doing so many special effects? And I think all of, like everything we see out the window in the train is like put in later. So
yeah.
Moon was not quite, not in that
Moon,
skin.
Moon had about 400 special effects shots. Yeah. In fact, for a lot of our wider shots, well, there was lots of digital set extension, and then for the character Gertie, in the wider shots, we had a CG version of him, and all the close-ups, he's a model. But I guess I'd worked in commercials before I worked in films and had the chance to do some pretty, use CG and use a lot of effects work. And that kind of is where I got my experience and grounding in that.
Yeah. And that was thanks to Tony Scott, right? Isn't he the one who helped
you? Yeah, he was the one who suggested that I go off to film school and leave graduate school, where I was suffering trying to pursue a graduate degree in philosophy. Wasn't okay. Going to take. I was never going to be a teacher.
Well, but you got some philosophy into the
I managed to squeeze some anyway. Into Moon, a little bit into Source Code.
That's right. Yeah. In the back.
Aside from some of the obvious references to Quantum Leap and some other notable science fiction films, what are some of your most influential or favorite science fiction films?
What are some of your favorite science fiction films?
You know, it kind of changes all the time, and it depends where my head's at and what I'm sort of working on, or you know, to be honest, every film I like is my favorite film ever every time I see it. but Blade Runner is always at the top of the list. I mean, Blade Runner is the greatest science fiction film ever made. Yeah, I'll state that definitively. I really believe, you know, it's an amazing film, and you feel like if you were to just pan the camera off of the actors and follow, first of all, you'd still be in that world if you panned the camera off. That's what it feels like to me. And it also feels like if you followed any one of those people wandering the streets, you'd probably have an amazing story in its own right. It's just the most fully realized and believable science fiction world in any film for me.
Yeah, what was the transition like moving from a relatively small film like Moon to big, much, much bigger budget?
Well, the huge difference in my particular case is that Jake brought me on board. So all of a sudden, it was kind of a package deal. You know, if you want to do the film and you want Jake in it, you need Duncan to direct it, which kind of gave me some leverage that I think a lot of directors trying to make that transition don't necessarily have. So that helped a lot. I also had, you know, we talked about Paul Hirsch a little bit. As soon as I had hired Paul Hirsch to do the movie, Paul sort of took me aside in a very fatherly way and said, I'm your editor. I don't work for the producers. I don't work for the actors. I work for you. And he was a man of his word. So throughout the process, he was on my side. So I had a pretty strong core team there backing me up, which made things a lot easier. But at the same time, you are working with a lot more money, and you do have a responsibility to, you know, bring people with you. You know, there's a lot of people involved, I guess it's the difference between driving a motorboat and piloting an oil rig. You know, it's that kind of thing. You can make small changes, and it takes a long time to get those changes through. But you know, as long as you let everyone know, you know, it's a lot more like advertising. And when I used to do advertising, you have clients, you have agencies, and you have a whole area. There's a whole bunch of chairs and a monitor just for them to watch what you're doing. And then you have your own little private area so you don't have to deal with them. But every time you want to make a change or you're about to shoot something, you go over there and you explain, this is what I'm doing, this is why I want to do it, you're going to love it, it's going to look like this. And you sort of, you have that kind of negotiation and bring them with you. And it wasn't like advertising completely, but it was a little bit more like that. When we were doing Moon, it was me, Sam Rockwell, and my producer, Stuart Fennigan, and if we wanted to do things, we just changed it. You know, that's how we worked.
You must have spent a lot of time in the editing room. The editing on this film is so intricate, and every shot is so important, and the way that you keep condensing the sequence is amazing. So are you there every...
Oh, no, yeah, I was there the whole time. I don't understand how you can, you know, shoot a film and then not be there while it's being put together. Yeah. You know, I mean, even with the amazing Paul Hirsch, I don't trust him. I want to do it. I want to be there.
And then just one other thing I want to ask was the, you know, we talk about the science fiction aspect, but there is this romantic story at the center and this relationship that develops, and it's, you know, strange because... he's not who she thinks he is, and the way that is able to actually develop. And I think you've said that that's something you discovered as you worked on the film, like how strong this relationship
is. Yeah, I mean, we knew up front that Michelle was going to be fantastic. I mean, I'd seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and she giving as good as she got with Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer. So, I mean, if someone can do that, I knew that she was going to be able to work with this. But there was a really good chemistry, I think, between Jake and her, and with a minimal, you know, I mean, it was a slight romance, but it was there, and I think her and Jake were really able to squeeze everything out of it and make it feel believable, especially within those 8 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Time for a few more. So over there.
Vis-a-vis Blade Runner. Number one, would you say this is your director's cut, or you think there may be a director's cut in the future? And whether alternative endings filmed that could be on a DVD in the future?
Is this the final version? Will we see director's cuts and different editions of the source code, maybe on a DVD?
I think this is it. I think this is the film that, I'm happy to release, and I don't think I would go back and, try and change anything. There was an alternative ending that was tested and tried, and it was the producer's ending, the romantic ending, and it was wrong. and I'm glad that we've gone with this one. I really am. Yeah, that's that.
But part of the funnier is that there's not a wasted minute. You feel it's like a totally
point. That's what I was going to say. Jake was available for a window of time. I mean, he just finished Prince of Persia. He was going to go off and do the press for the Prince of Persia, you know, worldwide PR. And during that window of opportunity that we had to shoot Source Code, we really, you know, it was a squeeze, and we got everything that we needed, but probably not anything bonus. In fact, things had to be pared down to really make sure we got the absolute essentials. So I don't think there really is the opportunity. I don't think there's the material to do any kind of other cut. This was, you know, there were some timing issues just to make sure things didn't feel flat at any point, but there wasn't any bonus scenes or anything like that.
Okay, up there.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you had any impressions of the technology that would allow them to link the consciousness over that. That was just what I was wondering most about, is the distance.
Yeah.
Like, I was wondering, wireless technology, or what were you thinking?
Well, yeah.
Wow, okay. So just about the technology of the link between Nevada and Chicago. It doesn't seem like that's that big a stretch once you get to this stage.
I'm pretty sure the original source code was on AT&T, and then they moved to Verizon to ensure they had the bandwidth.
It's definitely not T-Mobile. I'll tell you that. Yeah. Okay, over here. Yeah. Yeah, well, Jeffrey Wright, who gives a great performance. Yeah. How did you work with him and develop that?
Well, you know, Jeffrey Wright is an amazing actor. To me, he kind of reminds me of Sam Rockwell. He's one of those kind of really underrated but incredibly talented guys that I just love seeing whenever he's on screen. When I have having the opportunity to work with these people, you know, all four of these principal cast, I really do consider it my responsibility to give them an environment where they feel that they can do what is sort of in their head. And you know, I hire the best cinematographer I can. I hired Don Burgess on this particular film. I hire the best editor I can. If I'm hiring the best actors, it seems kind of bizarre for me to tell them what to do. I try and give them an environment where they can do the best that they're obviously talented enough to come up with. Now, if something's really not working, I'll give them suggestions. Like with Jake, I had an amazing time where I would, you know, we would capture the performance that he wanted to give, and then I'd give him suggestions, and we would take it in slightly weirder, more surreal directions. And some of that footage was really good, and we actually put it in the film. But really, it's about giving them an environment to do what they have in their heads, as long as it sort of fits the film. I think Jeffrey had this idea of what he wanted to do, and there was some real world personalities and characters that he was sort of loosely sort of basing them on, sort of an amalgam of these different people. And I just kind of went with it. I thought, yeah, this is kind of cool. It's one of these slight roles that could really easily just disappear. And I didn't feel that was fair to bring an actor like Jeffrey Wright onto a project and then have him just completely disappear into the background.
Okay. We'll take one more. So go ahead.
I love the reveal when we learn that his voice is actually being, that she's reading it.
Yeah.
Was that originally there, placed there, or did you play with it throughout the development, earlier or later?
Yeah.
So the reveal where she's reading his voice, when did that come about?
Funnily enough, that wasn't actually in the script. That was something I just thought there was an opportunity to add another little, you know, reveal at that moment. I like the idea of building some reveals. So we have that one, then we obviously have the reveal of the body later on. The body was a funny one, actually, because, you know, we were set on a particular rating, so it needed to be gory enough that it was really clear that he wasn't going anywhere. but not so gory that we couldn't get our PG-13.
Well, okay, if you make two more films, you can get a retrospective here at the museum. So please come back.
I'll keep working.
But thanks so much. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.